Hi, welcome to the Growth.me summary of Your Money or Your Life from Joe Dominguez and Vicky Robin. This book is different from other personal finance books because it talks about choice, freedom, and fulfillment instead of deprivation and discipline. You'll learn how to use money to achieve your authentic dreams and to escape the modern traps of consumption, clutter, and debt. Looking at the online reviews for this book, on Amazon it has 4.5 stars, and on Goodreads it has 4 stars. There were many positive reviews that found the ideas in the book practical and powerful, but there were some critical reviewers who didn't like that parts of the book were repetitive or sounded like a motivational seminar. So let's begin. Most personal finance plans fail because they're based on self-discipline. At least that's the viewpoint of the authors of this book, Your Money or Your Life. And wow, that is a very different point of view than most personal finance writers. Many people may feel it's a viewpoint that is absolutely refreshing. So I repeat that first sentence. They say most personal finance plans fail because they're based on self-discipline. You know, sometimes it feels like the articles on saving money that are out there are trying to make us feel bad for occasionally enjoying a latte or an avocado. This book, on the other hand, starts from the inside out. It says if we want to change our outer financial situation, then we must first change our deepest beliefs about money. If we do that, then it will feel effortless to save money, eliminate debt, and become financially free. So in this summary of the book, you're going to learn what money really is, and you may be surprised to find out most of us have no idea. You'll understand who you really are, so you can better escape society's pressures towards empty consumption. And you'll bring more consciousness to your life, specifically to how money is flowing in your life. Who are the authors? Well, Joe Dominguez wrote the original version of this book. He reached financial independence and retired at the young age of 31. He worked as a financial analyst and writer on Wall Street, but says he only made an average person's income. He was able to retire so early because he had an effective financial plan in place, a plan he later shared with the world in this book, Your Money or Your Life. Vicky Robin co-authored this book with Joe, and she's written other books about sustainable living. So our first lesson from this book is savings equal freedom. Seeing endless debt as a bottomless pit. Most of our parents and grandparents entered debt with the goal of paying it off quickly and then staying out of debt. They saved up beforehand to pay for large expenses, rather than putting them on the credit card or payment plans to worry about later. But very recently, everything has changed. In 2005, for the first time, the rate of savings in the US fell below 0%. Today, many people are eternally in debt and feel it's okay because, well, that's what everyone else is doing too. As an example, in my country of Canada, more than 50% of new car buyers are signing loans not for 3 years or 5 years, but 7 years. Not long ago, paying off a car for that long was unheard of. And that has other negative consequences, like increasing the price of cars over time, but that's a different story. So we've all been taught that debt is freedom because it lets us buy what we want now, but the reality is the opposite. Debt equals servitude, because with debt, we become trapped in jobs we hate and scared because even a small tragedy could turn our life upside down. So what's the answer? Savings. Savings equal freedom. The authors say we should have 6 months in emergency savings as our number one short-term financial goal. And that means we have enough money set aside to pay for 6 months of expenses if we suddenly can't work. And with that cushion of safety, we'll enjoy greater peace of mind that we have the support we need to overcome life's inevitable storms. And our number one long-term financial goal, should be full financial independence. That means making enough income passively from our savings so we don't need to work anymore. And by the end of this summary, I hope that you'll see how this is possible for you and a plan to get there. Now, there's another book that strongly emphasizes escaping society's matrix, and that is The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss. His approach is very different, focusing more on building an online business that provides passive income to fund our desired lifestyle. So, in that book, Tim Ferriss says we need to begin with asking more questions about all the rules and assumptions of society that we follow. As an example, why does almost everyone work 40 hours per week, no matter how much they make or what kind of work they do? It doesn't really make sense, does it, for every single job to require the exact same amount of time, but it's something we all have been taught to accept in society. And once we see that many of those old social norms are baseless, especially around finance and money, then we'll feel a lot more freedom and confidence to walk our own unique path. As Ferriss writes, if you are insecure, guess what? The rest of the world is too. Do not overestimate the competition and underestimate yourself. You are better than you think. End quote. You can learn more from him in our summary of the book, The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss on growth.me. To summarize lesson one, we've been taught that debt equals freedom, but in reality, debt makes us trapped and scared. Instead, savings equal freedom. Our number one goal in the short term must be 6 months of emergency savings, and in the long term, enough passive income to live without needing to work again. Lesson two is reject more, understanding how much consumption is enough. So in their financial seminars, Joe and Vicky, the authors, would often ask the audience how much more money they need. And guess what? Almost everyone always said they needed 50% to 100% more money. And that seems to prove that no matter how much money we make now, we will always feel that we need more. So we all know that money can't buy happiness, but what do our actions say? It's our actions that really demonstrate what we think and believe. As Robert Cialdini, a professor of psychology, wrote, our best evidence of what people truly feel and believe comes less from their words than from their deeds. That's one of my favorite quotes from his book Influence by Robert Cialdini, which we also have on growth.me. So why won't getting more make us any happier? There are two major reasons described in this book. First reason is called hedonic adaptation. That's just a fancy psychological term for saying we quickly get used to what we have. In other words, our expectations rise, and what we used to really, really want becomes normal. And that's why people who drive past us in a new luxury car don't seem to be any happier than those driving by in some old, used, beat-up car. Because when we buy something new, we do feel better for a little while, but that feeling quickly fades, and then a few months later, society comes and tells us we need just one more thing, and then later one more thing, and one more thing. And that all eventually leads to our second reason why getting more doesn't make us happier, which is number two, clutter. So eventually, we reach a point where each new thing that we buy actually makes us less happy. Because when we have too many things, that leads to clutter. We have objects that take up our space, resources, and attention, but they only make us feel more stressed and overwhelmed instead of adding something of value to our lives. That reminds me of a different quote that says, you can never get enough of what you don't really want. And I believe that one comes from the self-help author Wayne Dyer. What that means is that it's impossible to fill emotional or spiritual needs with material consumption, although that doesn't stop many of us from trying. Again, it says you can never get enough of what you don't really want. And to summarize lesson two, We all say money doesn't bring happiness, but our actions tell a different story. We seem to believe that getting more would make us happier. Many of us fall into habits of spending our money on things that not only don't bring us joy, but actually add to our unhappiness eventually because of the added clutter. Lesson 3 is, money is life energy, taking care of our most precious and irreplaceable resource. So to a lot of us, money can feel vague and abstract at times. Is it paper? Is it coins? Is it numbers on a computer screen? What is it really? Well, let's end this confusion now, because here is what it is. Our life energy. And this may be the most important idea in the whole book, so I'll repeat it. Money is your life energy. That means when you buy something, you're not really trading paper or coins or some digital bits for that thing. What you're really trading is some of your life energy. For example, let's say you made $20 an hour and bought some jeans that cost $40. Well, then what you've done is traded 2 hours of your life energy for those jeans. When we see money as life energy, that brings a lot of clarity to our spending. You can try it out yourself. Next time you buy something, convert the price into the hours you would have to work for that money, and you may never look at buying something the same way again. And that reminds me of what a famous classic writer named Henry David Thoreau once said, "The price of anything is the amount of life you exchange for it," end quote. Our life energy is finite. That means we only have a limited amount of it. So doesn't it make sense to treasure our life energy, to treat it with care and consciousness? I can hear you thinking, yes. Well, then that is the real meaning of the word frugality. Being frugal is not about being cheap, but it's about getting maximum fulfillment from our expenditures of life energy. For example, we can buy an expensive pair of shoes, and that can actually be frugal if those shoes are very high quality and they will last a long time and we will really enjoy them. In fact, it could be a lot more wasteful to buy 10 cheap pairs of shoes that we don't really like that end up sitting in our closet than it is to buy that one really nice expensive pair of shoes. So, to be more frugal, we can start from the inside out. The first step is to understand the importance of your personal values. Your values are simply what you find important. When we've lost touch with our values, then we resort to seeking pleasure and status through consumption of goods. So the second step, which ties into it, is to ask yourself questions to discover your values. And some of my favorite questions for that purpose include, what people do you admire and why? Or what would you do all day long if money were no worry? If you ask yourself questions like that, you'll connect with what you value. And that is the first step to spending your money in a way that values your life energy. And we'll be talking more about that very soon. So the main point here is, in lesson 3, it's that money is not just paper or digital bits. Money is our life energy, which is limited and irreplaceable. And being frugal means taking care of that life energy by spending it wisely to get maximum fulfillment according to our inner values. So that means the first step is getting in touch with what we find truly important. So lesson 4 is, find your real wage. Your job is probably more expensive than you think. By this time, we've laid the foundations of what kind of beliefs that we need to carry about money. So now in the rest of this book summary of Your Money or Your Life, we'll be discussing some of the author's practical ideas for changing our financial lives. So buckle your seatbelt because we're just getting started. So the first question that we need to answer is, what are we really selling 1 hour of our life energy for? Most of us think that answer is easy. It's the number on our paycheck, whatever they told us we're getting paid. But that number that we see on our paychecks can be very misleading. And so this book includes an exercise to calculate our real hourly wage. Basically, we start with our monthly income, and then we add how many additional hours that our job requires outside of work, and then we subtract how much money our job costs. So just adding all those extra costs in time or money that our job does cost us. That can include transportation. Maybe our job requires us to buy a second car and to maintain it and to fill up fuel more often, to buy more insurance, to buy clothing for work, extra grooming, extra meals for takeout, for lunch, not to mention all the extra money and time that we may need to unwind after work or to pay others to do the work we can't take care of, like daycare or home upgrades. So it's all those costs in terms of money and time. And when all of your job's additional costs are calculated, when you add them up, you may see that you're making much less than you thought. Most people do. And that may sound bad at first, it may feel bad, but it can often be good news because it means that your current job is not worth as much as you thought. It's paying you much less in net money than you thought it was. And many readers of this book have done the exercise and realized they could continue making the same amount of money at a different job that was closer to home, maybe easier to do or more flexible. So say the authors. And so they were able to quit their high-pressure jobs because they suddenly saw all kinds of invisible costs they'd never considered, and after they quit, they were much happier. And maybe some of us can do the same thing. Okay, I'm going to connect this to another popular personal finance book you've probably heard of called Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. It's about the story of Robert Kiyosaki learning from his rich dad as a kid. That was a man that was really his friend's father and a very successful entrepreneur. So the biggest lesson that he learned from that rich dad is the poor and the middle class work for money. The rich have money work for them. I'll repeat that. The poor and the middle class work for money. The rich have money work for them. In other words, poor and middle class people make their income from working, often per hour, but rich people buy or create assets that generate income whether or not they are working at that time. Those assets could include stocks, bonds, real estate. Entrepreneurs even create new assets like business, website, or social media presence that generates income. And we'll talk more about that in this book too in the future. But if you want a sneak peek, check out our summary of Rich Dad, Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki on growth.me. So to summarize lesson four, what are we trading each hour of our life energy for? We can start with the number on our paycheck, but then we should add the additional hours that we spend because of our job, and then add the additional expenses that we incur because of our job. And when we calculate those costs, then we'll know our real hourly wage. So lesson five now is no shame, no blame, looking back at our financial life without guilt. So the next exercise this book recommends is to gain more clarity on our financial past. And there are two steps for how to do this. First step is to add up your total lifetime earnings. That's how much money has passed through your life up to now. You can find this number by looking at your past tax returns or by contacting the right government office. Just add up all of your annual incomes up until now. And the second step is to find your current net worth. That just means how much is all your savings and possessions worth altogether right now. This is kind of what you've got to show for all those years of working and trading your life energy. So these exercises are about understanding where we are coming from so that we can later point ourselves towards a better direction. Now, if you find that you've lost a lot of that money that you worked for, and if feelings of guilt come up, the authors recommend we repeat a simple mantra to ourselves, which is no shame, no blame. No shame, no blame. The authors of Your Money or Your Life, they believe that bad feelings are not useful for changing our behavior. Instead, our behaviors will change automatically and kind of effortlessly when we have increased self-awareness. And we get that self-awareness by doing these kinds of exercises so that we know exactly how the energy of money has been flowing in our lives up until now. But there's no shame and no blame, because that is not really helpful. So I think this approach is quite unique for a personal finance book. And I'm reminded of a quote from the great psychologist Carl Rogers, who said, "When I accept myself just as I am, then I can change," end quote. I don't want to get off track here, but I also believe that honesty about our flaws leads to self-correction and improvement, while guilt and shame tends to cause self-delusion and denial. So to summarize lesson 5, seeing our financial past with clarity is the best way for us to begin getting on the right track for the future. We can do that by calculating our lifetime earnings and then our current net worth. If any bad feelings come up, remember, no shame, no blame. Next is lesson 6, raise your financial awareness, keeping track of how we spend our life energy. So at the very core of the system in this book, it's about keeping track of where our life energy, aka money, is going, keeping track. The authors believe that if we write down all of our spending and reflect on it regularly, then our behaviors will naturally shift, and over time, we'll be spending less on things that don't bring us fulfillment, and more of our life energy on what gives us joy. And so the financial system in Your Money or Your Life has 3 parts. Here's a very brief summary of the 3 parts of the system. The first part is to keep a daily money journal. So write down every single purchase, either in a notepad or in a mobile app, and that simple act will be increasing your self-awareness and consciousness about where your money is going. Part 2 is to add up your spending monthly. At the end of each month, go through those expenses you've been writing down, divide them into major categories, then find out how much you're spending in each category. Convert the dollars of each category into the amount of life energy that you spent. Then ask yourself, was it worth it? Put a plus or minus beside that category if you feel that you should be spending more or less according to your judgment. Or if you feel there should be no change in your spending in that category, just put a 0. So here you're judging your spending from the last month, seeing if it matches up to your values. And part 3 is to create a yearly wall chart. This chart will only have 2 lines in the beginning. One line for monthly income and a second line for monthly expenses. So each month, you'll be updating this chart to see whether these numbers have gone up or down. Make sure you put it on a wall somewhere that you'll often see it, because that'll just bring more awareness and consciousness. The authors say that after 3 months, most people who follow this system will find their expenses going down automatically simply from the increased awareness of where their money is going. And that means on that wall chart that you've been making, your monthly expenses will slowly be going down, and then you'll begin to have some savings. Personally, I've used systems like this in the past, not so much for finance, but more for productivity. Because I'm self-employed, I don't have a boss that keeps me accountable every day, so I have to keep track of my own work to make sure I'm not sliding into habits that are unproductive. That means I've often kept track of my work hours on daily charts or graphs, even that I've hung on a wall where I always saw them. There's an influential business writer named Peter Drucker who says, "What gets measured gets managed." I found that simply measuring the number of productive hours I work, that's a great motivator to increase my productivity. To summarize lesson 6, writing down where money is flowing in our lives will increase our awareness, which will slowly but automatically improve our future behaviors. That means writing down all our daily purchases and monthly analyzing those purchases to find out where our spending doesn't align with our values. Finally, it is also about making a monthly wall chart that shows how our income and expenses are changing over time. And next we have lesson 7, aim towards freedom, putting your savings to work for you through investing. Over time, on that monthly annual wool chart, you'll begin to see a growing gap between the two lines, between your decreasing expenses and your steady income. That gap is called your savings. Now, those savings can be put to work for you, earning you additional income through investing. So the authors say that we can later add a third line to that wool chart, which is called income from investments. At first, that income will probably be very small, $20 or $50 per month, but it will grow steadily over time. Now here's the really exciting part. When that line for income from investments grows higher than our line for expenses, then we are free. I'll repeat that. When the line for income from investments grows higher than our line of expenses, then we become free. That's right, free like a bird. In the book, they call it the crossover point. Basically, that's the day you're making enough money passively from your savings that you no longer need to work. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. When we have those savings that begin growing, what should we put them into? What should someone invest in? Well, this book talks about some basic investing concepts that we should all know, like stocks and bonds. A stock means that we buy a small part of a company, while a bond means that we lend money to a big institution and they pay us a bit of interest. And the institutions are often a government or a large corporation. So those are the two major types of investments that we should all know about, and those are the basics of them. Now, stocks and bonds both have their pros and cons. Generally speaking, investing in bonds returns less income to us, they make us less money, but they're more safe and stable in price. On the other hand, stocks provide a higher income, but they're a little more risky and volatile. Volatile means the stock price tends to go up and down more in the short term. So 30 years ago, when the first edition of this book was published, Joe Dominguez actually was investing only in bonds, specifically something called U.S. Treasury bonds. However, some critics say that probably would not be the best path for most people today because bonds pay far less money than they did 30 years ago. We won't make nearly as much money. So what should we do? Well, most of the top-rated personal finance books that I've read recommend focusing on stock index funds mixed with some bonds for greater stability. And if you're starting to feel a little confused by what I just said, then I don't blame you. Investing can feel complicated and intimidating, especially if we're just beginning. But if you want to learn more details, I highly recommend you take a look at our summary of the book, The Millionaire Teacher by Andrew Hallam. It's the best book I've read so far that explains how to invest for financial freedom in a simple way. But the bottom line is that the author, 30 years ago, relied more on U.S. bonds, but today we'll probably look more at something like stock index funds, and that is how we achieve financial freedom, by investing in those kinds of assets and over time increasing our income from investments. So let's finish up this book summary with three practical action steps for how we could apply this book to our lives. Action step one is to keep track of a daily behavior for 2 weeks. So if we do need to save more money, we could keep track of our daily expenses, like this book recommends. If we need to be more productive, we could keep track of our work hours every day. If we need to lose weight, we could keep track of each meal, what we ate. Remember, no shame, no blame. And after 2 weeks, notice how the increased self-awareness affects your behavior. Can you simply change your behavior by bringing more consciousness to what you have been doing? So action step number two is, next time you're about to make a big purchase, translate the money into the hours of life energy. How long would you need to work to pay for that purchase? And would it bring you enough fulfillment to justify that cost? So try it out and take a look. Does that exercise change your attitude towards spending the money? Action step number three is remove three pieces of clutter from your life. Think about what possessions you've not used in months or years. Could you sell them on eBay or online classifieds, or maybe donate them to a local secondhand shop? See how you feel afterwards if you do this step. I often find that when I give away something that I have not used for a long time, I feel a bit of relief instead of loss. It feels better to have less stuff that's not taking up space. Okay, so I hope you found something enjoyable or useful in this book summary, and I'll see you in the next one.